Yeah, it was this funny experience of like being by myself in this house, eating way too many cheese puffs, and just like drawing until my hand fell off.
Welcome to Did I Do That? It's a podcast about graphic designers and the mistakes we make on the way to making something great, because it's all part of the process. I'm Sean Schumacher, and joining me today, a very special guest. She's an award-winning brand designer, illustrator, published author, and musician with the band Phosphine, who published their fourth album, Transmute, last September. So I'm only a little late to the plugs for that one. She has over a decade of industry. Just make sure you have the most amount of spit in your mouth when you start reading.
All of the spit.
All of the spit. Good, good liquidy. People love the liquid sound from the mouth. She has over a decade of... Oh, boy.
This is the best introduction ever.
Truly, truly one of my all-time greats. She has over a decade of industry experience. Will I get through the sentence this time? She has over a decade of industry experience working with clients ranging from Google to Amazon to PayPal and many more. And these days she's a senior. These days she serves as a senior brand designer at Zendesk. It's Rachel Frankel. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here on what might be my worst talking episode ever. Truly a low point on the Sean talking scale.
Well, you know, I think talking is overrated. At least 50% of the time. So totally makes sense I'm doing a podcast.
Oh, no. Well, I'm really glad you're here. You are in fact, a listener of this show.
I am. It's true.
So I'm sure you are familiar with our incredibly successful 2023 slogan for the show, coined by the great Eason Yang, make LinkedIn weird.
Yes, always.
That was a goal that we...
Weirder than it already is.
Well...
if possible.
The good news is that 2023 slogan worked. And the bad news is that 2023 slogan worked, and maybe worked a little too good, because there's some big news in LinkedIn land. They rolled out a humongous announcement out there. First of all, Link Talk, because stories are coming to LinkedIn. Stories, the feature that all apps need to have. Notes app, get ready for stories.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Photos, somewhere. Get ready for stories. Stories are just everywhere. And so LinkedIn is getting vertical video stories for the benefit of someone. No one's quite sure who.
Maybe just Gary Vaynerchuk, and that's about it.
An incredible array of people that you can block now on LinkedIn just from the content of their LinkedIn stories. That'll be so exciting. The other incredible announcement, though, is LinkedIn gaming. That's right.
Oh,
they're getting into
dear.
The gaming space.
That just made my stomach turn. Oh,
I don't know why. It sounds so exciting. And I found a tweet from Nima Oji, who is a independent app researcher. I shouldn't say tweet because this is on the service X.
What, a zeet?
I guess so. No one's quite sure what these are. This
is just... Maybe it's whatever Elon and Grimes named their second kid.
Yeah.
I believe it was.
Oh, yes.
Just a bunch of decimal points and... symbols.
They opened up the Unicode palette and they just, you know, hit a bunch of keys.
Pretty much.
And that's how we got all those names and how X is going to be branding things from here on out. But yes, the Zeet or whatever it is that LinkedIn is working on in-app games. And these are going to be a few different games, and companies will be ranked in the games based on the scores of their employees. And Nima goes on to say, pretty cool and fun, in my opinion, which I'm not sure is an opinion that I share. And I'm gonna turn the screen so you can enjoy the incredible quality of these games.
Oh.
There's one that we're looking at right now called Blueprint, which has the incredible power of a gradient.
Wow.
And
amazing.
I guess it's
never
a quiz
seen it
game.
Before.
Seems bad. And then, of course, there's a ranking screen. And then their other incredible gaming innovation is none other than Minesweeper. They're just making Minesweeper again.
I mean, as a, you know, Minesweeper enthusiast back in the day, maybe not a problem, but also begs the question of, did this really need to happen again?
It's a great question. You know, I know every company in the social space is looking over the corpse of Twitter, and they're just vultures. They're picking at it. They're trying to get everything they can out of it. And
yes.
I'm not sure that these are the things that I would want to necessarily pull out. But then a lot of the other stuff is much worse. So maybe that's fine. The other thing that just occurs to me about this is I feel like companies are really, really on the offensive right now about what they consider to be wage theft.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
I don't know when this game product would be played where they would be happy with it. If they want to do well in the rankings, maybe that speaks to a bad thing or...
Yeah.
When are the employees meant to be playing these games is a big question that I have.
Whenever they're not worrying about getting laid off, I guess.
Oh, so never.
Never.
Well, that'll be an exciting time for this product to just have a launch that has no one using it. No
yeah,
users.
It's kind of giving Space Force, if I'm being completely honest.
Space Force, the incredibly necessary,
priority thing that our government has ever put investment towards.
Well,
aside from our defense budget.
You know, our former president, watched the movie Armageddon and is like, well, we could have a meteor come at us at any time.
It's lit.
We need some sort of, space military to defeat this meteor.
And clearly.
That will do it. Space Force. God. I forgot about that, and I forgot about the Steve Carell show on, I want to say, Netflix that was also themed about Space Force.
They really went hard on that.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't go hard on the writing of it because it wasn't
very
funny.
That's what I heard. Yeah, unfortunately.
Seems like that's where you want to focus your attention if you're writing a comedy, but
yeah,
what do I know?
Especially a satire.
Especially
a
satire. You don't just try to, run off the fumes of Space Force. Just get that joke out there as fast as possible and come up with no other jokes.
Yeah, especially Mike Pence fumes, because you're not really working with a lot of horsepower on that one.
I assume Mike Pence fumes are the gases that come off of him when he calls his wife mommy. Just the horrible, noxious fumes that produces.
Or that one fly that landed on his head.
Well, the flies are, of course, attracted to those fumes.
Yes. They have good taste, I guess.
Well, they're trying as best they can to consume them before other creatures do. You know, it's sort of a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
You didn't come here today, Rachel, I think, to talk about Mike Pence's fumes.
I didn't.
I mean, it would be a shock.
To me, too.
To us all. You came here to talk about kind of how you got started in design. How did you kind of get into design to begin with?
Well, it's definitely one of those slightly twist and turny kind of stories, but not super, didn't start over in, I want to be a biochemist land at all. But
is not unusual, too.
Yeah. No, I feel like it's always interesting, especially hearing from people who didn't start out in design, like what brought them over and where they came from. But for me personally, in high school, I was getting a little more interested in like costume design. I always loved illustration. I was really into things like anime growing up and, trying to like trace and then freehand all those cell drawings. I have fond memories of that. Yeah, so I always knew I loved drawing. I definitely like drew all over birthday cards that I would give to family members and stuff. So it was always something I did. I never really put it to the test in terms of like, oh, do I want to do that professionally?
Did you have an idea of what a career doing that would even be?
Not totally. My parents were both numbers people, so very like left, traditionally maybe marked as left brain, more analytical people, where I was like this kind of like creative, probably undiagnosed ADD kid over here, just like living in my own world, easily distracted. I think that's also always a sign of like, okay, maybe this person will grow up and do weird creative things. But yeah, I always loved like storytelling. I'm pretty sure I started reading before I started talking. So like kids' books and those illustrations are some core memories too. But yeah, I remember in 11th grade, I had this amazing drawing class where we had a great teacher, but honestly, what I remember more than the drawing exercises was when he would, you know, wordlessly roll a TV in, and then for some inexplicable reason, we would watch different episodes of America's Next Top Model. It was all honestly, right. Like, I have no notes. I have such fond memories of that class. I made so many great nerdy friends, but also, like, most importantly, because that show has so many problems in retrospect, I think there was an open house at school or something, and, you know, my mom came along, and my teacher, Mr. Saxon, I think was his name, he just made, like, a side comment to my mom, like, oh, like, she's really good at this. And it was like, oh, you know, because I think when you're growing up, you're like, I think sometimes it's hard to even tell yourself, like, you're good at something or anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know what the context is that you could, like, take the skills that you're taking in high school into anything else.
But, yeah. You're just, like, trying to absorb it all and mostly succeed. But then you also have hormones and feelings and everything else.
Yeah. Like, geometry is not top of list for most people.
So, yeah, I think that was a moment that stuck with me. But, you know, music, I feel like throughout life, music and visual art have always kind of been, like, duking it out in terms of, like, what are you going to do more of and, like, what's more important? And I think for a long time, I felt like I had to just choose one. So I started out at Cal State Northridge, CSUN, with a focus on music composition. It was super intense. And CSUN probably still have a great music program and really great instructors. But I mean, like any creative pursuit, like, it was just really intensive from the get-go. Lots of units, lots of, like, you know, solo hours in the practice room on the piano or, you know, whatever else. You're trying to memorize pitch and all this stuff. And I kind of felt myself falling out of love with it because it had become everything. You know, it was like I worked on it so intensely at school. I worked on music outside of school. And when it became this all-consuming thing, I was like, oh, I don't know. This is feeling right.
Do you think that had, like, in high school, you're getting to bop around between a bunch of different things. Do you think having that space to do that, like, actually made you more creative? And then you get into a, you know, that like the blinders on headspace of being in a program that's that rigid.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I think that was a huge transition too. Aside from just being 18 and you're, like, still figuring out, oh, I'm still definitely a kid and not an adult, even though my age says otherwise. And yeah, just like you put it, just in high school, you know, you're encouraged with all these electives and, like, you know, I did choir growing up, which was always a great, I think it was a great thing for me, especially being, like, a shy, introverted only child, just to, like, get used to being in more of a group environment. And yeah, it's so hard. And it's like, I know for career's sake and practicality's sake, a lot of us go directly into college right after high school. But I think in retrospect, I can really understand more and more why some kids take a gap year or just, like, ease into it, because that's it. Those are big decisions you have to make.
It really is. And I mean, like, we are a mostly non-traditional school here at PSU. And I think that is usually to the benefit of the folks who have taken some time off, even if it's, you know, if it's a year, if it's 15 years, and found what their passion is and let that drive them. Whereas that thing of, like, the momentum of just going into the thing and feeling like you got to do this thing. And then it's like, oh, God, I actually hate this.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah. And, you know, it was, I think, like, my state at the time was like, I'm trying to love this thing. I'm trying to feel like it's the right move. But, you know, I kept, like, on campus, I would see people carting around, like, big portfolios and kind of, like, look wistly after them and be like, oh, like, is this, am I kind of forcing the hand of this thing? Like, should I be doing something else? And my...
You were literally having that moment of the meme where the guy's looking at the person. Except she's holding a portfolio case.
Yes, yes. I'm lusty guy after portfolio meme. but... Yeah, I think my friends at the time, you know, they knew I was capable in visual arts, and they were like, you know, I really like, I think you are geared more towards this. Like, I would really want to see you pursue it. And so I think it was that so the first semester of college, I stuck in my music program. And then if I remember right, I think I made an appointment with an advisor and just switched over to art and design. So yeah, it was a big switch. And then at CSUN, they actually did have an illustration program. So got to like dive in, do a couple like super preliminary Adobe classes, you know, like figure drawing and just base level like principles of design. It's funny because learning the principles of design at the time, I was like, boring. But it's like, I think in retrospect, you kind of see how all the little pieces add up. And, you know, I think as you grow into some type of creative career, you learn to appreciate those things as they show up.
Oh, absolutely. It's so easy to brush past that stuff. Like, I remember having a color theory class that I could not concentrate on at all. And I wish now that I had, because I have no brain for color whatsoever.
Color's really difficult. I want to shout out my old professor, Danielle, who used to teach at SF State. So once I transferred from Cal State Northridge to SF State, I think the first semester I was there, I had a color theory class with her, and we had like the color aid paper. I don't know if you ever worked with that.
No, what is that?
It's interesting. It's kind of, it's not like dissimilar to Pantone, but basically it's like this coated paper, and there's all sorts of, there's like a huge range of color. And we would do these interesting exercises where we'd have to like try to color match or like create like a range of hues, kind of like a gradient or something like that, or just play around with like, oh, make a complementary color palette. And it was like, when, if I look back, you know, I think that's one of the most useful classes I had, because color is so tricky, and you really have to like work at it to, and you know, it's, I think it's not necessarily like you have to follow the rules exactly, but it's just, it's so subjective too. So
that sounds a lot better than what we were doing. That sounds, I think, pretty good.
She's on the East Coast now, and she has been for some time, but if she ever does like a remote class, I'll let you know.
Yeah. So you're now transferred over to SF State.
Yeah.
First of all, why SF State? Like,
yeah, so Cal State Northridge was like 4 miles from the house I grew up in. And I think at the time, like from ages 18 to 20, I was not ready to move away. You know, I was pretty like tied to my friends and my family and community. But I think especially, you know, a year or two into college, you know, I started to kind of get more curious about leaving and just seeing what other places held. And San Francisco was one of those places I had been just a couple times. And, you know, I think being a queer person, like there's naturally a draw to a place like that for many reasons. But yeah, I just felt really optimistic. SF State had supposedly a great art program, and it felt like the right move. It was close enough where I wasn't too far from home. And so, yeah, I started there in 2008. And I think the way their structure was set up, you had like your core curriculum and then, you know, general education stuff, but you could have like a segment, like a certain segment focus. And so for me, that was queer studies. And
hey,
I think to learn more about queer history and just like queer facts in a very queer place, like it was just, you know, no regrets
at
all.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, there were definitely a lot of moments where I was just sort of sitting and listening to the professors like, whoa, this feels like, it's like a bigger than me kind of moment where you're like, you're learning. And, you know, I don't want to assume for other programs, but it's like, you're probably learning a lot more like progressive and radical facts than some other people are. And I think when I think about, you know, going straight into art school versus going to a more like open-ended general state school or something like that, like I think it challenges a lot of assumptions about what's ultimately better for people.
Yeah. So like what do you end up doing in their, not illustration program, but in their kind of like drawing program?
Yeah, so they had a really great painting and drawing program. I have really good memories of a lot of those professors. Gail Dawson was a really talented painting professor who I worked really closely with, Paul Prochenko too. And yeah, it was a lot of oil painting, which I don't do anymore.
What do you mean? Oil painting is the future. We're all going to be oil painting soon. Throw away our phones.
Yeah, it's like I still remember the smell, which is like probably a big reason why I don't do it anymore. In addition to it, just it takes a long time
to
do
dries.
Painting.
Oh God!
You know, in now in the Procreate days, it's like, oh, I don't have to wait for this to dry or anything. But it was a really fun medium to play with. I think like it helped push my drawing abilities a lot. Oil or just painting of any kind, even if it's watercolor or gouache, like you have to kind of plan ahead a little bit. Like, oh, if you want to do an underpainting layer. So things like that. It's like I never want that to feel prescriptive, like, oh, you have to know what it's like to do this super old-timey craft. But I think like you can generally learn a lot from that stuff and take whatever with you that you want to.
Yeah. I mean, it does force precision, which I think is a really incredible like thing that I think we forget about in the purely digital realm. You can't just do a command Z if you put a brush stroke in the wrong place.
But I did try to hit the undo button sometimes, but like I would just blend it out. You know, that's one nice thing about oil is that it doesn't dry quickly unless you put medium in it. But
You had some palette scrapers.
Just, oh yeah. Yeah. Love a good like palette knife moment.
Oh yeah.
I do miss doing that sometimes, but, yeah, I remember like getting towards, I think I was in my last semester and we did an independent study. So you create your own body of work and, you know, try to present it in a cohesive manner. And it was a little bit brutal. Like it wasn't like I failed or anything, but I remember getting some feedback where I think that feeling of like, oh shit, did I do the wrong thing in school came back where some of the feedback was like, oh, this feels generic. And I think what I ended up presenting was a mix of paintings and then pencil drawings, because pencil was like my other kind of core medium. And I was like, I don't think it's generic at all. I just think I want to be an illustrator.
Yeah.
I think when you talk about illustration, like it's such a, I think in a lot of ways, it's a very derivative art form, even though like there are a lot of really original and visionary people like working today. I think it's impossible to not like draw inspiration from the people who came before. Like, so yeah, I think getting that feedback was sort of a small light bulb moment, like, oh, okay. Maybe like fine art and that kind of practice isn't what's going to serve me long term, but yeah, after that, it was like, okay, congrats, you have a degree. Now here's the real world.
Yeah. And you're in San Francisco, a famously inexpensive city.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, thankfully moved there right as like the tide was starting to turn and the Google was starting to come in pretty hard. And I just called it the Google. Just wanted to acknowledge that. Unfortunately.
Well, the Google was starting to come in and,
yes,
you know,
the Googs
populate all the office buildings with higher and
stuff.
Higher rents.
Yeah.
Special
too.
Buses that just serve their employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I quickly just tried to find a job, you know, could not really be too choosy at the time. This was like 2011. So
also a great time economically.
Oh,
really
fantastic.
One of the top times to be alive.
I mean, as millennials, you know, we're just totally nailing it.
Yeah.
Timing.
Boy, the economy's been good the last
couldn't
my
agree
entire
more.
Working life. Really, really good and solid.
Yeah. So I ended up getting a job at a frame shop in the Marina District of San Francisco, which was its own education. and yeah, it was really interesting. I had had jobs before, but never like a salesy kind of job where you're like trying to convince people to buy the more ornate thing, get a double mat. And I think like being more introverted, you're like, oh God, having to sell a product and like talk to people. It's kind of like my idea of hell at the time. I have great memories of that job because, you know, I think for one thing, it really challenged me. And, you know, you have to just talk to a range of different types of people.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of like genuinely sweet moms who wanted to frame like every single drawing their kids ever made. But there are also a lot of like Karens, you know, you have to kind of take what comes in and just sort of like it's not personal. Like, it's just the way they are, and it's probably not about you. So, like, I feel like those face-to-face kind of jobs really, like, teach you a lot about how to deal with people in general, which, especially if you're going to be a designer, like, you really do need that skill.
Yeah, you really, really do. So that, I mean, that's a pretty, I would say, a pretty normal job to, you know, come out of school too with an art degree, but that's not where you stayed. Where did you go from there?
It was kind of a bumpy ride the next couple years. I took another job that wasn't maybe like an obvious move, which was unfortunately working at a law firm for a minute. So for me, it was mostly like an administrative assistant type of position. But yeah, like I had to report to attorneys and help them manage their caseloads. And, you know, it's a lot of like, make sure the details are exactly right because legally they have to be. And definitely like not, you know, a soul enriching type of move, but
no, I mean, to think that you're even going out to San Francisco to be in the arts and now you're in the probably the most anti-art that vibe possible.
I did you know, even in that type of environment, because again, you know, it wasn't like a lot of choices were available at the time. Even in that environment, like I was able to make friends and learn things that even though they weren't obviously tied to creative work, it's just like, hey, stay fucking organized, like make sure you're on top of your shit, do things in a timely manner, like those base level like adult skills. So yeah, I was there for about a year and a half, and then I got a job, a similar type of job as like a studio assistant at this Berkeley advertising agency that will remain nameless. Yeah, I was there for almost a year. I have a lot of, at the time, this place made me scream quite a bit on my off hours, but I have some core memories, one of which being the studio assistant's job. There were a few of us for this agency. It was our job to kind of be the DJ during the day and, you know, have like a good playlist going. And it was at the time, I think The Idler Wheel by Fiona Apple had come out and I was like obsessed with it. So I was playing it and I think it was like a copywriter who sort of like kind of crept up to me like, hey, so-and-so's the head of this agency, not naming them either. That so-and-so really hates Fiona Apple. So, you know, would you mind switching it to something else? And
how did they know?
I think that gives you a lens into the kind of culture that was at this place. So
cool vibes.
Yeah, super great, cool, normal, not man baby vibes.
Very chill and very healthy for everyone.
Yeah, obviously. So I remember, you know, obviously I switched it to something else at the time, but it would still creep back in from time to time just so, you know, it's like I'm making bullshit salary. This guy doesn't even know my name. I'm going to just use this as my little piece of revenge. So that's a little secret drop many years later.
I'm sure the output of that agency dropped precipitously all the Fiona
losing
Apple that he was getting
right
in the system.
Yeah, you know, I'm here to cause
my creative juices are being drained. Why?
Yes.
I'm withering. Oh,
that damn Fiona Apple.
Yeah. This is kryptonite.
But yeah, I made a really good friend there named Ben, and I just remember a lot of times walking around South Berkeley and just kind of being open with each other. And he knew that like I was creative and did illustration. And I think even though it wasn't the best environment, it exposed me to what designers do. And I was like, that doesn't seem that hard. Like, it doesn't seem like the biggest stretch from what I was doing. And I think, you know, at the time I was like, okay, you know, maybe I can park that, you know, oh, I don't want to like create stuff on a computer. I don't want to like lose my touch with analog art making to be like, no, maybe like they live more together than I thought they did.
Yeah. We were talking about this a little bit before the recording too, like that. And I think it's not uncommon for folks who do come out of like very art focused programs to be a little bit more wary of the idea of like working on a computer and how that is separate. And there are a lot of good things about working physically, yes. but the computer is also not an enemy.
No, it's not. And I, you know, I kind of kicked myself at times for just like pushing that off for so long. But I think especially when I started, you know, for a time I sold prints on Etsy, and, you know, to do that, you have to have like a certain level of know-how, like, okay, how do you knock out the values to make your drawing, you know, to like preserve the quality enough for an actual print. So I was picking up those things kind of on my own for a while, but then, you know, I hit a point at this last studio assistant job where I was like, you know what, I kind of need to hit pause. It became really clear to me what the next step was. My partner at the time, now my husband, Matt, he worked at Bay Area Video Coalition, which is a really great nonprofit in the Bay Area. And they, at the time, I think they still have this program for unemployed folks in the Bay Area. You can take free certificate programs.
Hey.
So they happen to have one in graphic and web design. And so it was something Matt had floated to me for a minute, like, hey, you know, just so you know, like, these classes are available. And they also have versions where if you are working somewhere and the company works it out with with BayVac, which is what they're called for short, you can also take classes as an employee. So ultimately, I decided to quit my job. I had, you know, saved up enough to get myself by for a minute. And I went right into this program. And so it was just like a deeper dive into the Adobe suite, you know, actually learning how to use the pen tool correctly and all that stuff, learning InDesign, a little bit of web design, which, you know, that's unfortunately that one hasn't stuck with me as
no,
well.
No, that's, I mean, none of those skills from that era are transferable to anything now,
yeah,
unfortunately.
Like no one's building an HTML site from scratch with text.
Although if there's anyone who wants to, please hit me up.
I would
love that.
Yeah.
I know how to do it real good.
Yeah. So yeah, it was like 6 months of kind of an intensive like learning period. And it was kind of a nice feeling to just, it was like being back in school, like for a really like microwaved amount of time. But yeah, just it felt like, okay, this is the right track. Like after all these years, I think this is what was meant to happen. And yeah, after finishing that, I got like a freelance contract gig at Cost Plus World Market. Also a local Bay Area business. That was really interesting. They had this whole fake store set up at their warehouse for like their merchandising team, where they would like sort of rehearse like, okay, we're going to put this section over here. And it's like, oh, that's a whole job.
Just that's like whole prototyping thing.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's weird that's your one job that you do. But, you know, of course, as I've gotten older, it's like, yeah, duh, yeah. That is a thing for a reason.
I guess cost pluses are fantastically standardized. I feel like I've been in many
and they all look
identical.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wild.
So yeah, that was like my first post BayVac job. And then I got a job at a now mostly defunct startup called Creative Live, which is sort of a cousin to like Skillshare or Udemy.
Oh, sure. I remember Creative Live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I ended up working there for about 3 years. I learned so much. It was definitely like more of an all hands on deck situation with our creative team. So, you know, we had like a couple studios where we'd film classes. So creating graphics for that was really fun. I had a creative director there who kind of pushed me to bring some of my analog stuff into the work. So like lettering and type was sort of a burgeoning interest of mine even before I started designing. And so I started doing a lot of hand lettering for them, which was fun. And yeah, like startup life is very, very weird. Just evergreen statement. But it was definitely an education and definitely like a move I didn't regret. But yeah, after 3 years, Matt and I had like visited Portland several times before we ended up moving here. And it was just always this place that like, oh, like if only like if one of us gets a job there, or, you know, if there's some way we can work it out. So it was kind of like our white whale of a move So that's sort of like the next leg of my journey.
And then, like Ahab, you captured that white whale and put it in whale jail, which is, I assume, what happens in that book. I haven't read it. Yeah, like you moved to Portland. And what ends up being the thing that gets you out here?
You know, I think for a few years we kept kind of like keeping our eye peeled. I actually had a sort of semi-close call where I interviewed for, I think it was for Hannah Anderson.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I got like decently far, and then I didn't end up getting it, which felt kind of crushing at the time, but it's okay. I forgive them.
It happens.
They didn't know.
It happens to everybody.
Yeah. So I guess to backtrack just a little bit, I had this book idea sort of percolating in my brain for a couple years that was focused on music history, but more from like a woman's perspective. So that ended up actually happening. I worked with Chronicle Books on that, and you know, it was like this crazy big like personal pursuit that came to life like as I was still working full time at Creative Live. And
how did you like? But there's still a big leap. I know. How did you like get, because that's a big thing to pitch a book.
Yeah. I should back up to like, I think it was 2014. I was really inspired by magazines like Tom Tom and She Shreds, and sort of had this like, oh, maybe I'll make a zine or something featuring like illustrations and little short bios of women musicians. And then Lisa Congdon is someone who I really looked up to for a long time. And she was at the time still in the Bay Area. And, you know, I had kind of like a shoot my shot moment where I just kind of reached out to her cold and asked if she wanted to meet up and grab coffee sometime, because we both were living in Oakland at the time. And thankfully she said yes. Wow. I had like taken one of her classes, I think it was this place called Makeshift Society, a couple years back. And so that was where I first met her. And yeah, we ended up meeting up, and she was super like gracious and kind. And yeah, she ended up becoming kind of a mentor to me over time. And you know, she did something really, really amazing of her, which was she introduced me and a few of her other illustrator friends to Bridget Watson Payne at Chronicle Books. I believe she's freelance now, but for a long time she was their main art book editor. And Bridget at the time was like, yeah, like send me your pitch. Like I want to hear from you. And wow. I think, you know, publishing is one of those things where like you don't often get that sentiment. Like they probably don't want to hear from you because they hear from too many people. And I think just because, you know, it's like, okay, it's a local publisher. This editor is being directly encouraging of like, you know, getting pitches. That was sort of like the seed that was planted, like, oh, maybe this zine could be a bigger thing. And so the next challenge was finding the time to put a proposal together.
Yeah, they're a lot of work.
Yes. Yeah, it was, you know, and thankfully, like their guidelines were really thorough, but, you know, thorough in the way that makes you feel like the this is fine dog. Like, oh, my God, there's no way I'm going to get this done. Like, especially when you work full time, it's just a challenge. But
boy, that's a lot of bullet points, huh? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it was like the number of illustrations they wanted to see. Ooh. And then the style I worked in was a little more representational and detailed. So it was just like, ugh, you know, kind of doing it to myself a little bit. But it's like I've committed. So, yeah, what really ended up helping was getting an art residency through Drop, Forge, and Tool. I don't know if they're still active, but it was this great program out in upstate New York where Catherine Doherty and her husband had like, you know, a pretty sizable property, and they would invite like artists of many types to come stay with them and make whatever they were making. You know, they had people from like theater troupes come in to work on their stuff, and obviously a lot of like 2D artists, you know, drawing and painting or crafting, knitting, what have you. And so I think it was early 2017, I got to go out there for like a week and a half. And yeah, it was this funny experience of like being by myself in this house, eating way too many cheese puffs, and just like drawing until my hand fell off, and listening to lots of podcasts. But yeah, and it was like bitter cold. It was probably like February
Oh, no. February in upstate New York?
Yeah, I didn't think that one through, unfortunately.
Well, you're from out here. You didn't know.
I didn't know. And now I know. Yeah, it's like these really bitterly cold walks to like the main street.
Oof.
But it's kind of that, like, not to romanticize like a shitty situation, but just like, oh, it's kind of a fun thing to be out of your element. I think especially, you know, being a Californian, we grew up with such like boring, amazing weather. And you
us and
take
our boring vitamin D.
Yeah, that we totally took for granted.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was just like, oh, this is how other people live. And they actually have to deal with weather and things like that. So yeah, it was this funny, like, kind of cut off a little bit from the world. But I met cool people out in Hudson. And there was like a fun little wrap-up event where I ended up making like a very rudimentary zine version of the project. That ended up being like the main sort of artifact I included in the proposal. Yeah, and apparently at the event they had, I heard from Catherine that like Beck's mom stopped by and like picked up a zine, which I have like a huge amount of FOMO that I didn't meet her, but she left like a anti-Trump pin as like a... Because, you know, I was just giving those away, but she like left that as like a exchange. I don't have it anymore, unfortunately, but that was a cool little souvenir. That was like, cool. Beck's mom's a fan, I guess.
Beck's mom, too.
Yeah.
Beck is one of those people that you don't really think of as having parents.
A mom? Yeah, yeah, no, he just showed up here one day.
Yeah, Beck emerged just fully teleported. Formed like Athena out of Zeus's forehead.
Yes.
Clad in armor, making
obviously.
Weird rhyming words that don't make any sense.
Yes, obviously.
And being in that one episode of Futurama. What are other Beck things that I remember?
Yeah. So, got that residency done and then made my way back. And then it was pretty soon after that that I sent the proposal in. And then it was like at least a few months of waiting to hear back. And there's that weird period where you're like, oh, okay. Bridget wrote me back and she's like, I love it. I want to move forward with it, which is like,
hey!
You know, had to like do a happy dance and cry outside the office when I heard that. But then came like this kind of ominous sounding phase where it's like, oh, I have to take it to the acquisition board.
Oh,
and
God.
You're like, oh, God, no! who is that and who's involved? But thankfully, I think they understood like the goal of the project and they said, yeah, let's do this thing. And
They had their meeting, their shadowy meeting,
yes,
where they're at
the shadow
of,
realm. Yeah.
Yeah, like very tall lecterns.
Yeah,
or something.
I'm just picturing like Dementor robe type situations.
Oh, yeah. But you can only see their outlines.
Yeah.
You know,
they
each have three gavels. Why?
Yeah.
Why
and
do they need
like
that
a,
many?
A three-headed hydra somewhere, of course.
I think we're just reinventing the Venture Brothers now.
Yes. Yeah, so the book was a go, and then I realized that they needed me to do it in a... Well, when I say do it, it was more like get the first draft of everything done and in a pretty final place within 6 months.
Wow. Wow. Wow, wow.
Yeah, so...
That's a lot.
It's a lot on top of working, and, you know, of course... My dumb husband and I decided to get married in the middle of all this. And thankfully, we didn't get married till later in summer 2018. So there are these like staggered deadlines. But then in the mix of all that, we're trying to record another album for Phosphine. And so 2018 was like, it's still the craziest year of my life aside from pandemic.
You're writing a book, you're recording an album, and you're working full time.
Yeah, and then gearing up for a wedding.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
You know, we at least tried to keep...
I've forgotten that part.
Yeah, and we tried to keep the wedding pretty, like, chill as far as weddings go. It was a smaller event, so that definitely helped. But yeah, I'm sure you can imagine just balancing the mix of stuff was its own adventure. But I managed to get through that six-month period. I sent over my materials. And thankfully, it's like there's that big rush. And I don't know how other people's experiences are, but there's that big rush up front. And then, you know, the editorial team kind of like takes their time and evaluates it. And it's actually a little more chill after that. So then, because, you know, there could just be no chill that year at all, I think... It was that March 2018 where Matt and I had just kind of come to the conclusion, like, if we want to move to Portland, we need to just move there and yeah. take a chance and maybe risk it all. And so we decided to move there. And so from like April through August, that those were some of our last months in the Bay Area. You know, I left my job at Creative Live. I went freelance for the first time. And yeah, it was like one of those big life shifts. And we ended up here in September 2018. And yeah, we both started over. I got a job at Cambia Health.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like my first design gig here. And honestly, I was trying to be pretty open. I just took, you know, I don't want to say I took the first thing that opened up, but, you know, it seems like a good move, stability.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, like, coming off of a startup too, that the health space is very stable, barring an event that happens about 2 years from that date, but otherwise very stable.
Yeah. One would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was there maybe not the longest period of time. You know, unfortunately, I'm just someone who, if I'm not really feeling it creatively, it's hard for me to sort of feign it and like push that aside. And, you know, with it being healthcare, like the work was very dry. A lot of it was print focused. Not that I have an issue with print, but I'm sure you know the type of print I'm talking about.
It's
a lot of,
not pleasant.
It's like, here's your exam screening information. You know,
it's but like, it's the kind of thing that you always throw away immediately and never read. And that also makes you just feel really good about the work.
Yeah. Like maybe not the most inspiring document to work on, cause you know, it's just going to get thrown out.
Yeah. Kind of the same way that when I was working a previous job and I was so excited about a piece that I just made, and then I had someone else going through my mail and being like, junk, junk, junk. And like the thing that I had just made was just in the middle of that junk pile. And oh, yeah, this is what other people think of that. Oh, well, whoops.
Yeah, you're like,
whoops.
Holding back tears over here.
Well, that was a couple weeks of my life that I invested in that.
Way to just discard that. Cool. Thank you so much. So, yeah, I ended up leaving Cambia and going freelance again for at least a couple years. And, you know, freelance is like its own adventure with many ups and downs, but I was grateful I did that. And then both Matt and I were freelance for a minute. And weirdly enough, I think especially when the pandemic hit, it was the right move to be freelance. Especially, you know, with what happened to a lot of poor folks who were working full time, who were hit. But yeah, you know, we kind of just like grinned and bared it. You know, when you and your partner are both freelance or like both in the same professional kind of situation, there's like good and bad that comes with it. It's like you both know what that type of anxiety feels like, so you can commiserate on it. But it's also like it's hard when, you know, one of you isn't like set up with that stability. You know, it's a little bit just nervy at times. But yeah, I ended up stopping freelance. I had a little stint at laundry service, which was sort of my first time being like full time on the agency side. I had done work for agencies here already. And yeah, that was another kind of like test situation where, oh, like, is this the right move? Did I belong at an agency? And, you know, learned pretty quickly that like agencies can really vary in terms of the type of stuff they worked on. And, you know, and this is probably still the case, laundry service is very focused on like social media and like content. Yeah. And I think at that time, you know, I was still making personal work, personal illustration work, and I would share a lot of it on social media. But I was also, I think in the pandemic too, probably not alone in this, like was just getting a little disillusioned by the idea of like, okay, I'm making stuff, but who am I making it for?
Yeah.
You know, am I making it for views and likes or and little hearts, like, or am I making it for a bigger reason? And just with all that percolating and then like having to actually do that or think that way for my job, I just was realizing that wasn't the right fit either. And Zendesk was a brand I had always admired for a long time. They've had some really talented creative folks come through there, a lot of whom are still there. And so they were always sort of on my radar, even back when I was in the Bay Area. But yeah, they ended up opening a role for a senior brand designer a couple years ago. And thankfully, I ended up getting it. And so that's also been its own education, really challenging, but like in the good way. And I'm just always inspired by what like my teammates are doing. It's a really multidisciplinary team and everyone's just so accountable. And it's like, it's nice to have like found a home, I think a professional home, but it's great because I feel like, you know, finding your home professionally, it just kind of like inspires and motivates all the creative stuff you do outside of it. At least that's been my experience.
What's that thing where your goals align, I think is the hardest thing. And like, to go back to what you were saying before about like kind of leaving laundry service and feeling like the way that they were measuring things was maybe different than how you were, like before the recording, we were talking a little bit about like putting projects out into the world and you don't always see what the outcomes are. But I think there's also something that can be so debilitating creatively to know too much about what the outcomes are and to be measuring it by things that are kind of a little bit out of your control. Like,
it's like a weird relationship creative work has to like the numbers, like the ROIs and the KPIs and all those terrible acronyms.
All kinds of weird things that people pretend are any kind of anything, but are just made up.
Yeah.
They're measuring arbitrary nonsense.
Yeah. You know, of course, I think especially like branding work, you know, has some implications on those kinds of results, but it's like, you've got to hope that the people at the top are looking at beyond the numbers and beyond like the actual data and just, I mean, I think that's what inspired me so much about branding and kind of falling into branding from being so keen on illustration is like branding is so focused on storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's very, it can be very emotional when it's done really well. And so, you know, it's, you know, I think some people think about branding as just like, oh, well, it's your logo and your color palette. And sometimes it is just that if you want it to be, but it's just a really fun problem to solve. And it's like, I'm just excited to know that like, oh, that's the thing. Like, that's very much the thing that I'm interested in.
Yeah. And I like having some stability in like how you approach it, but still getting to vary it. Like, it seems like kind of the best of both worlds, getting to do like in-house branding.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, you know, some people might, you know, after a certain point, you're like, oh, you know, I'm so sick of using these typefaces or this color palette. But I think if you have a decent, at least a decent brand system, like there's always opportunities to extend on it. There's plenty of room to play around. And I think like one lesson from even like the analog art making days is like limitations are a good thing.
Yeah.
For you.
Absolutely.
For your brain.
Absolutely. So. It is so easy to get bogged down in the, it could be anything.
Yes.
The worst projects in my life have been like, you just do whatever you want. I don't know. Just have fun
Nightmare
with it.
Nightmare scenario for me. I hate that.
Pitch us something and then you'll regret immediately what gets chosen. So don't worry about that.
Yeah. No, I, big fan of limitations, of having prompts, of knowing what lane to stay in. That's something like I've always really wanted and kind of needed, especially with illustration work. I got to do a little bit of editorial illustration when I was freelancing, and like it's terrifying. You're like, well, yeah, okay, have a really witty, cool idea in 48 hours.
Yeah,
think you can do that?
I think the timelines are the worst part of the editorial illustration world.
Yeah, the timelines and the fees, which are like, you know, I went to Icon 22. It was my first time going to an Icon. And
oh, I'm jealous. That seems like a very fun conference to go to.
It's, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's a really fun time. Everyone is so friendly. But, you know, a big topic at that one was how the rates haven't changed in like 40 years.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's just one like problem that's emblematic of a lot of others in the creative field in terms of how much people are making and how the work is valued. But it's just unfortunate because illustration is so essential, in my opinion.
It really is.
Yeah. My coworker, Alenka, is our lead illustrator at Zendesk. And, you know, she's built out like an entire house style for us. And, you know, illustration, when you talk about originality, it's such a like loaded thing. And I think it's harder than ever to make something that feels truly unique. But she has a really healthy perspective on it, which is that like nothing is really ever original. And I think once you let go of that idea, you don't get as bogged down by it. But yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's funny because illustration is something I don't personally do a ton of in my own time anymore. But it's okay because I think like professionally, I've just been so indecisive that like I crave variety at the end of the day.
Like, I definitely started more on an illustration track as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't do any of it. But I think that's so normal, too, to be...
It's like you're not always going to be doing the same thing your whole life.
You want different things as you, like, change and grow. And, like, you know, the things that I do as design now, I mean, for one, this is kind of part of that, which is, if I tried to explain this to my 2009 self, what would they think?
They'd be like, come again? What?
Huh? What? Podcast. What's that? You mean the Ricky Gervais show? Jordan, Jesse Go. What are the two podcasts I listened to in that era?
Yeah.
It's such a strange thing to think of, like, the thing that motivated you initially is probably not what is going to keep you going. I do want to return, though, to a thing that was motivating you initially, the music side, because we've kind of touched on it a little bit,
yes.
But like this whole time, you've been in a band with your husband.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So Matt and I started playing music together like shortly before we started dating. And for a while, it was just kind of this nameless, like, fun thing we were doing. Because I had, you know, been in one quote-unquote band with a former friend of mine. But it was, you know, we never released anything in a real way. It was back in like the MySpace days.
Oh, sure. But you had a MySpace page.
Yes. Which is, you know, the basically the diploma for musicians.
Exactly. The banner of legitimacy in 2006.
That and the Pure Volume site, if I remember right. God, made me feel so ancient saying that.
Oh, no.
So we were kind of a two-piece initially, and then it's a cute, funny story. Matt and I are like huge fans of the National, like more of the old National stuff. But there was this cool event where Matt Berninger and Aaron Dessner were hosting the songwriting event at the Fillmore. I think this was like late 2013. And Matt's a very like on the dot, like plans ahead kind of person. And he's like, oh, I'm getting there like hours ahead of time to get a good seat. And the only... You know, he thought he was going to get there and people would be camped out because, you know, the National was pretty big at the time. And the only other person who was there was this guy, Kevin. And so they're both just like awkwardly standing around each other at the front of the Fillmore. And then that...
The Fillmore being a fairly large venue, too.
Yes. So they're both just out there in on Geary Boulevard or whatever it is. And they're both just kind of like, we perceive each other, but we're not saying anything. And eventually, I think Matt went over and was like, hey, how's it going? And they just struck up a conversation. I think they ended up going to Starbucks, which it told me something because Matt, even back then, was a coffee snob.
But they gave up their place in line?
Yeah, oh, they're just like, oh, this is like way more chill than either of us thought it was going to be. So they just ended up going off to talk, and eventually I met up with them because I came from work, and yeah, we just all hit it off, and Kevin seemed cool. We found out he played bass and guitar, and Matt and I left and we're like, oh, like maybe that could be something. And and Kevin lived in Petaluma at the time. We were in Temescal in Oakland, and Matt and I had found this practice space in I think it was South Berkeley, and we invited Kevin over just to kind of like do a test. You know, we had never done this before, like auditioning band members or anything. And it definitely didn't feel like that. It just felt more like this, like very casual. And we kind of jammed on a few things. And I think at the end of it, we're like, yeah, like, do you want to be in Phosphine? And he said yes. And yeah, we ended up releasing our first album that following year in 2014, which, yeah, every time we've recorded, I learned so much. It's clear what mistakes we have made in the process. Recording that first album was a lesson in scoping ourselves, because we were like, oh yeah, we're recording at a professional studio for the first time. Totally makes sense to record 9 songs in 4 days.
Oh no.
With layers and overdubs and many vocal takes. And yeah, that ain't it, folks.
No.
If you're curious, that's definitely not the move. But
not,
we,
not a lot yeah. of songs are recorded just sort of live to tape anymore, it turns out.
No, no. Yeah,
it's not 1956.
No, and it's the studio we recorded at, Tiny Telephone. They're big on like analog tape recording. That's also very expensive, and we couldn't afford that at the time.
Big on analog tape, small on telephones.
Yeah, yeah. Somehow didn't have many rotary phones or anything like that.
Well, they should correct that.
Yeah, sort of a branding issue, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
But
maybe the telephones are so tiny that you can't see them. Like they're like, you know, microscopic.
They're telephones in your mind.
Yeah.
And I'm dialing 911.
Picture a telephone.
But yeah, you know, it was rough, but we got it done. And it's funny because I think especially now being, you know, like 10 years into this band and like now knowing what we can do and how good the recording and production can be, it's funny listening to those songs because, you know, you hear everything, especially being the ones who recorded it.
Well, if there's one thing I've learned about audio production, it's that you learn a lot, and the only way you can learn it is by doing more
trial and error.
Of it.
Yes.
Sorry for anyone who had to listen to the early episodes of this show.
But yeah, it's. I think there's something just really sweet and emotional about the recording process because you are genuinely like recording a moment in time, and for better or worse, like you hear all your mistakes and all the takes where you're like, oh, I could have done that a little bit better, but you have to just let go at a certain time. And yeah, we kept releasing music over time. We came out with a small EP, I think, in 2016. And then because it was the year of No Chill, in 2018, we recorded our second full-length album, Lotus Eaters, but then didn't end up releasing it until like mid-pandemic in July of 2020.
Well, you had a lot going on. I think putting the album release aside, I think is fair.
Yeah. That, and it was kind of a combo of trying to shop it around to labels, which was, you know, its own kind of grueling period where I think Matt and I learned a lot about that side of it.
Yeah. It's good to remember that there are industries in worse shape than ours.
Yeah. No kidding.
Ooh.
Yeah. I could talk a lot about that, but I think there's a lot implied there. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, we decided to self-release, and it was actually, you know, we were hoping to do a release show and do all that fun stuff, but obviously March 2020, it was clear that was not going to happen.
Yeah.
But it was actually great because we got to just release a record and we didn't have to do anything else other than, you know, do some interviews and press about it. That we kind of sought out ourselves, and Matt did a lot of that work. But yeah, I think in a time where we were just all so separated from each other, I think it was nice. It was nice to have that feeling of putting something out there that people could connect with. And it almost felt like people were connecting with it more than usual because we weren't all distracted by typical life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I feel like there was a real, like, you know, just lack of stuff that was being put out, especially early on.
Yeah, a lot of stuff had to like get put on hold, or albums that were like halfway done.
Like I remember like TV shows that were being put out in like April having like warnings. This was recorded before the pandemic. Don't worry about it.
Like no one's wearing a mask and you're judging them even though they're just characters. Like, oh,
they're just characters interacting in 2019. Yeah.
Where's her PPE? But yeah, so that was the second to last record we released, and then last year we released Transmute, which was our third full length, and we're already working on another one.
So that's exciting.
I think there's something really like symbiotic about like visual art informing music and then the other way around, and I think to some extent I kind of didn't pay enough attention to how music was another like pull towards visual art with all the stuff that is associated with it, like gig posters and actual like CD booklet design in those days. Yeah. So it's like they all really feed into each other. But yeah, for the band, like I've made a lot of our promotional graphics, and like, you know, when we do print posters, that's been a fun thing for me to try out, and then designing our album booklets and things like that. So it's just, it's like a fun exercise for me. I think up until now, we've done mostly like illustrative or type-based things for the band. So I think on our next cover, we're hoping to just do like, oh, let's have someone photograph us. Like, we're at that point now where it doesn't need to be like a whole behind the curtain thing. Like, oh, put up an image because we're so mysterious. Like, okay, we can show our faces.
Yeah. You can truly reveal the makers of the thing.
Yes.
If people actually want to go get any of Phosphine's album, where do they go to do that?
Yeah, so I think the best place to go would be phosphinepdx.bandcamp.com. I'm pretty sure that's the correct URL.
And that Bandcamp is great because all the proceeds go directly to you, basically. Yes.
Yeah. As of now, Bandcamp is in kind of a weird, like, questionable spot, but generally still doing the right thing there. But we're also on streaming. We're on Spotify, Apple Music, all the places.
Yeah. Support artists, please.
Yes, please, you know, do that. Especially other local bands from Portland.
Yeah. And if people want to go get your book. Which I believe is titled She Can Really Lay It Down, 50 Rebels, Rockers, and Music Revolutionaries, parentheses, who happen to be women. Where do they go to do that?
Yeah, so I would highly recommend if you're shopping online, go to IndieBound. That's a great way to support local bookstores. Bookshop is another one, but obviously Powell's, especially if you're here in Portland. But yeah, mostly wherever books are sold. You can call your shops in advance, but I'm going to avoid recommending the big A. But, you know, maybe Barnes & Noble if you have to.
Yeah, I think we should all maybe try to avoid the big A.
Yeah.
A little bit more lately. He's getting real weird with his cowboy hat and his...
Yeah, the Blue Origin, whatever.
Yeah. I guess you're sort of some sort of rocket cowboy now, sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Beyonce has now co-opted that brand.
Yeah. So.
Sorry to you, Mr. Bezos.
Well, I know our 2024 slogan, which we decided at the beginning of this season, was to replace Mark Zuckerberg with Jesse Eisenberg. We need to find someone who can replace Mr. Rocketship Cowboy Hat.
Ooh, yeah.
I don't know who that would be. Is it Pitbull? He kind of is starting to look a little bit like
Pitbull. That's a good shout. I will take it personally. Sure. I can work with that.
We'll make that happen. If people want to find more about your work, Rachel, where did they go to do that?
Yeah, so it is just my full name, which is racheleevefrankel.com.
Yes, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely.
It's been so fun.
It's been a great time.
As we're recording this, too, it is Easter Sunday and also Trans and NB Day of Visibility. Yay. Just wanted to kind of shout that out here. And I know I don't talk about it very much. I actually don't even think I've said it on the show. But, you know, I identify as non-binary. And, you know, I think it is a good time to be, you know, celebrating the trans and non-binary folks in your life, because it is kind of not a great time for, you know, just stuff, just life right now. Just wanted to shout that out here at the end. Also, hey, thank you to you, the listeners of this show. If you got a moment, please rate, review, and subscribe to this show wherever you hear it. Ratings and reviews in particular are a big help, and sharing the show with a friend is an even bigger one. Spread the good word. If there is maybe somewhere that you'd rather hear the show, besides where you're hearing it now, I don't know. That's weird, but sure, whatever you want to do. I don't know your life. I don't know why you're making the choices that you are. This is starting to sound just like I'm blaming the listeners, which is maybe not the right energy to be bringing to this, but okay. But I don't know. If you want your choice of options, go to didididothat.design, and you can listen to it there, or you can see all kinds of other places that you can hear it. Didididothat.design is also where you can find some good images that go along with each and every episode, and get linked out to where we are on LinkedIn, Instagram, and more. Go play games in support of us on LinkedIn. Yes, set your company to Did I Do That and win all the LinkedIn games when those come out.
Yes, let's start that wage theft.
Yeah. All the wages that I'm paying you, the listeners. Stop stealing them by playing games to elevate us as a company. Like, what is the goal?
Question mark.
Why? It's the underwear gnomes. Question mark, question mark, question mark. Money. Okay, what are the question marks?
Did you say underwear gnomes?
Oh, that's a South Park episode from 700 years ago.
Sounds like it should be a LinkedIn game.
That's way too dynamic for, you know, their oh, yeah, exciting
the
dreams
is
of
off the chain
gradient and color Minesweeper. Ooh, wow.
Big things happening over at LinkedIn Games, obviously.
Hey, LinkedIn, do you know you can hire visual designers too?
What?
Yeah.
I wonder where we can find them.
It's not just engineers. Yeah. Anyway, you can follow us on LinkedIn. So I guess that's the goal of all that. This is a real show. This has been Did I Do That? I'm Sean Schumacher. And as we always say at the close of every episode...
I don't know.
That's what we always say. Okay, bye. Dear God. I got really chaotic at the end, and I'm not sure why.
That's amazing. I was here for it.
Truly, truly, the rails just stopped, but the train was already moving at like 70 miles an hour. Or, hey, you know, there's typefaces from other places than Adobe fonts. You can actually go get them anywhere, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
There's myriad typefaces.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you don't just have to like buy your prom dress at Macy's. You can go thrifting instead.
You don't have to go to Mr. Tuxedo or whatever it is on.
I mean, that was my first stop, 7. Obviously.
Of course. Who doesn't want to go in Mr. Tuxedo? I've been in there many times and I've never known why. Never had anything to buy there.
I mean, with a name like that, you just have to go in. There's no other option.
I don't think the store is actually called Mr. Tuxedo now that I think about it, but that's
I
how
really
I always...
hope it is though.
it's the one on Grand. What
Mr. Formal.
It?
I used
Mr. Formal. That's what it is.
Yes. Right by that really chaotic looking office supply store.
Paper. I don't know if we have that. Oh, God.
Paper's gone. We don't make it anymore.
I got a pen in my pocket. You want that one? Oh, you wanted like 50 of them? Shit. Oh, man.
Best I can do is 2.5.
I'll give you the cap, too. No, that's for a different pen.
Here's some liquid ink I'm going to pass over in my palm.
We got a whole bunch of whiteout. You want that? Does that do anything for you? I mean, I bet you could find some black paper and write on it that way. Oh, we're going to make it work. I promise. Buckman Businesses.
It could be its own hour, I'm sure.